This lesson isn't limited to movies or Broadway. The Post-it note, for instance, was invented by a chemical engineer who, frustrated by bookmarks falling out of his church hymnal, decided to use a new adhesive to make them stay put. Cellophane was developed by an exasperated chemist looking for a way to protect tablecloths from wine spills. Infant formula was created in part by an exhausted father who suspended vegetable nutrients and powder so he could feed his crying child in the middle of the night. Those inventors looked to their own lives as the raw materials for innovation. What's notable is that, in each case, they were often in an emotional state. We're more likely to recognize discoveries hidden in our own experiences when necessity pushes us, when panic or frustrations cause us to throw old ideas into new settings. Psychologists call this creative desperation. Not all creativity relies on panic, of course. But research by the cognitive psychologist Gary Klein indicates that roughly 20% of creative breakthroughs are preceded by an anxiety akin to the stress that accompanied Frozen's development or the pressures Robbins forced onto his West Side Story collaborators. Effective brokers aren't cool and collected. They're often worried and afraid. A few months after the Story Trust meeting, the songwriters Bobby Lopez and Kristen Anderson Lopez were walking through Prospect Park in Brooklyn, anxious about all the songs they needed to write, when Kristen asked, "What would it feel like if you were Elsa?" As they walked past swing sets and joggers, Kristen and Bobby began discussing what they would do if they were cursed and despised for something they couldn't control. What if you tried to be good your entire life, and it didn't matter because people constantly judged you? She asked. Kristen knew this feeling. She had felt other parents' looks when she let their daughters eat ice cream instead of healthy snacks. She'd felt glances when she and Bobby let their girls watch an iPad inside a restaurant because they wanted a moment of peace. Perhaps Kristen wasn't cursed with some deadly power, but she knew what it felt like to be judged. It didn't feel fair. It wasn't her fault that she wanted a career. It wasn't her fault that she wanted to be a good mom and be a good wife and a successful songwriter. And so, inevitably, that meant things like home-packed snacks and sparkling dinner conversation, not to mention thank you notes and exercise and replying to emails, sometimes fell by the wayside. She didn't want to apologize for not being perfect. She didn't think she needed to. And she didn't think Elsa should have to apologize for being flawed either. "Elsa has tried to do everything right all her life," Kristen said to Bobby. "Now she's being punished for being herself, and the only way out is for her to stop caring, to let it all go." As they walked, they began riffing, singing snippets of lyrics. "What if they wrote a song that started with a fairy tale opening," Bobby suggested, "like the stories they read to their girls at night?" "Then Elsa could talk about the pressures of being a good girl," said Kristen. She jumped up on a picnic bench. "She could change into a woman," she said. "That's what growing up is, letting go of the things you shouldn't have to care about." She began singing to an audience of trees and trash cans, trying out lyrics for Elsa to convey that she's done being the good girl, that she doesn't care what anyone thinks anymore. Bobby was recording her impromptu song on his iPhone. Kristen spread her arms. "Let it go, let it go. That perfect girl is gone." "I think you just figured out the chorus," said Bobby. Back in their apartment, they recorded a rough draft of the song in their makeshift studio. In the background were the clinks of plates from the Greek restaurant downstairs. The next day, they emailed it to Buck, Lee, and the rest of the Frozen team. It was part power ballad and part classical aria, but infused with Kristen's and Bobby's frustrations and the emancipation they felt when they let go of people's expectations. When the Frozen team gathered at the Disney headquarters the next morning, they put "Let It Go" on the sound system. Chris Montan, Disney's head of music, slammed his hand on the table. "That's it," he said. "That's our song. That's what this whole movie is about." "I have to go rewrite the beginning of the movie," said Lee. "I was so happy," Lee told me later. "So relieved. We had struggled for so long, and then we heard Let It Go, and finally, it felt like we had broken through. We could see the movie. We had been carrying the pieces in our heads, but we needed someone to show us ourselves in the characters, to make them familiar. Let It Go made Elsa feel like one of us." 4. 7 months later, the Frozen team had the first two-thirds of the film figured out. They knew how to make Anna and Elsa likable while driving them apart to create the tension the film needed. They knew how to portray the sisters as hopeful yet troubled. They had even transformed Olaf, the effing snowman, into a lovable sidekick. Everything was falling into place. Except they had no idea how to end the film. "It was this huge puzzle," said Andrew Milstein, president of Walt Disney Animation Studios. "We tried everything. We knew we wanted Anna to sacrifice herself to save Elsa. We knew we wanted the movie's true love to exist between the sisters. But we had to earn that ending. It had to feel real." When filmmakers get stuck at Disney, it's referred to as spinning. Spinning occurs because you're in a rut and can't see your project from different perspectives anymore, said Ed Catmull. "So much of the creative process relies on achieving distance, on not becoming overly attached to your creation." But the Frozen team had become so comfortable with their vision of the sisters, so relieved to have figured out the movie's basics, so grateful that the creative desperation had lifted a bit, that they had lost their ability to see other paths. This problem is familiar to anyone who has worked on a long-term creative project. As innovation brokers bring together different perspectives, a creative energy is often released that is heightened by a small amount of tension, such as the pressure that comes from deadlines or clashes that result when people from different backgrounds meld ideas, or the stresses of collaborators pushing us to do more. And these tensions can lead to greater creativity because all those differences trigger divergent thinking, the ability to see something new when you are forced to look at an idea from someone else's point of view, said Francesca Gino, who studies the psychology of creativity at Harvard Business School. But when that tension disappears, when you solve the big problem and everyone starts seeing things the same way, people also sometimes start thinking alike and forgetting all the options they have. The Frozen team had solved almost all their problems. No one wanted to lose all the progress they had already made. But they couldn't figure out how to end the film. "You start spinning when your flexibility drops," said Catmull. "You get so devoted to what you've already created. But you have to be willing to kill your darlings to go forward. If you can't let go of what you've worked so hard to achieve, it ends up trapping you." So Disney's executives made a change. "We had to shake things up," said Catmull. "We had to jolt everyone. So we made Jen Lee a second director." In one sense, this change should not have made a huge difference. Lee was already the film's writer. Naming her as a second director, with equal authority to Chris Buck, didn't alter who was participating in the daily conversations. It didn't add any new voices to meetings. And Lee herself was the first to admit that she was as stuck as everyone else. But, Disney executives hoped, disrupting the team's dynamics just slightly might be enough to stop everyone from spinning in place. In the 1950s, a biologist named Joseph Connell began traveling between his home in California and the rainforests and coral reefs of Australia in an effort to understand why some parts of the world housed such incredible biological diversity while other regions were so ecologically bland. Connell had picked Australia for two reasons. First, he hated learning new languages. Second, Australia's forests and seascapes offered perfect examples of biological diversity and homogeneity in close proximity. There were long stretches of the Australian coast where hundreds of different kinds of corals, fish, and sea vegetation lived in very close quarters. Less than a quarter mile away, in another portion of the sea that seemed essentially the same, that diversity would plummet, and you might find only one or two kinds of coral and plants. Similarly, some pockets of Australia's rainforests contained dozens of different types of trees, lichen, mushrooms, and vines flourishing side by side. But just 100 yards away, that would dwindle to just one species of each. Connell wanted to understand why nature's diversity, its capacity for creative origination, was distributed so unevenly. His quest began in the Queensland rainforests, 12,600 square miles that contain everything from forest canopies to eucalyptus groves, as well as the Daintree Tropical Forest, where conifers and ferns grow right at the edge of the sea, and the Yungala National Park, where trees are so dense that, at ground level, it can be nearly lightless in the middle of the day. As Connell spent his days walking under green canopies and hacking through thick foliage, he found pockets of biodiversity that seemed to erupt out of nowhere. Then, just a few minutes away, that medley would dwindle until just one or two species remained. What explained this diversity and homogeneity? Eventually, Connell began noticing something similar at the center of each pocket of biodiversity. There was often evidence that a large tree had fallen. Sometimes he would find a decaying trunk or a deep indentation in the soil. In other verdant pockets, he found charred remains underneath the topsoil, suggesting that a fire, perhaps caused by lightning, had blazed for a brief but intense period before the rainforest's dampness had extinguished the flames. These fallen trees and fires, Connell came to believe, played a crucial role in allowing species to emerge. Why? Because at some point, there had been a gap in the forest where the trees had come down or had burned, and that gap was big enough to let sunlight in and allow other species to compete, Connell told me. Retired now, he lives in Santa Barbara, but he remembers the details from those trips. By the time I found some areas, years had passed since the fire or the tree fall, and so new trees had grown in their place and were blocking out the sun again, he said. But there had been a time when enough light had made it through that other species were able to claim some territory. There had been some disturbance that had given new plants a chance to compete. In those regions where trees hadn't fallen or fires hadn't occurred, one species had become dominant and had crowded out all competitors. Put differently, once a species solved the problem of survival, it pushed other alternatives away. But if something altered the ecosystem just a little bit, then biodiversity exploded. Only up to a point, though, Connell told me. If the gap in the forest was too big, it had the opposite effect. In those parts of the rainforest where loggers had cleared entire fields, where a huge storm had wiped out whole sections of the forest, or where a fire had spread too far, there was much less diversity, even decades later. If the trauma to the landscape was too great, only the hardiest trees or vines could survive. Next, Connell looked at reefs along the Australian coast. Here, too, he found a similar pattern. In some places, there was a dizzying assortment of coral and seaweed living in close proximity, while, just a few minutes by boat away, one species of fast-growing coral had dominated every square inch. The difference, Connell found, was the frequency and intensity of waves and storms. In those areas with high biodiversity, mid-sized waves and moderate storms came through occasionally. Alternately, in places with no waves or storms, just a handful of species dominated. Or, when waves were too powerful or storms came through too often, they would scrub the reef clean. It seemed as if nature's creative capacities depended on some kind of periodic disturbance, like a tree fall or an occasional storm, that temporarily upset the natural environment. But the disturbance couldn't be too small or too big. It had to be just the right size. Intermediate disturbances are critical, Connell told me. Within biology, this has become known as the intermediate disturbance hypothesis, which holds that local species diversity is maximized when ecological disturbance is neither too rare nor too frequent. There are other theories that explain diversification in different ways, but the intermediate disturbance hypothesis has become a staple of biology. The idea is that every habitat is colonized by a variety of species, but over time, one or a few tend to win out, said Steve Palumbi, the director of Stanford's Marine Station in Monterey, California. This is called competitive exclusion. If there are no disturbances to the environment, then the strongest species become so entrenched that nothing else can compete. Similarly, if there are massive, frequent disturbances, only the hardiest species grow back. But if there are intermediate disturbances, then numerous species bloom, and nature's creative capacities flourish. Human creativity, of course, is different from biological diversity. It's an imprecise analogy to compare a falling tree in the Australian rainforest to a change in management at Disney. Let's play with a comparison for a moment, though, because it offers a valuable lesson. When strong ideas take root, they can sometimes crowd out competitors so thoroughly that alternatives can't prosper. So sometimes the best way to spark creativity is by disturbing things just enough to let some light through. The thing I noticed when I first became a director was that the change was subtle, but at the same time, very real, Jennifer Lee told me. When you're a writer, there's certain things you know a film needs, but you're just one voice. You don't want to seem defensive or presumptuous because other people have just as many suggestions, and your job is to integrate everyone's ideas. A director, though, is in charge. So when I became a director, I felt like I had to listen even more closely to what everyone was saying, because that was my job now. And as I listened, I started picking up on things I hadn't noticed before. Some of the animators, for instance, were pushing to use the blizzard at the end of the film as a metaphor for the character's internal turmoil. Others thought they should withhold any foreshadowing to make the ending a surprise. As a writer, Lee had viewed those suggestions as devices. But now she understood people were asking for clarity, for a direction in which every choice, from the weather on screen to choices about what is hidden or revealed, reflected a core idea. A few months after Lee's promotion, Kristen Anderson Lopez, the songwriter, sent Lee an email. They had been speaking almost every day for a year at this point. They talked at night and sent each other texts during the day. Their friendship didn't end when Lee became a director, but it changed a little bit. Kristen was riding a school bus, chaperoning her second-grade daughter on a class trip to the American Museum of Natural History in New York City, when she pulled out her phone and typed a message to Lee. "Yesterday I went to therapy," she wrote. She and her therapist had discussed the Frozen team members' differing opinions about how the movie should end. They had talked about Lee's ascension to director. "I was discussing dynamics and politics and power and all that bullshit. And who do you listen to and how do you start?" she typed. Then she asked me, "Why do you do it?" And after parsing out the money and ego stuff, it all really comes down to the fact that I have things I need to share about the human experience, Anderson Lopez typed. I want to take what I have learned or felt or experienced and help people by sharing it. What is it about this Frozen story that you, Bobby, and I have to say? Kristen asked. For me, it has something to do with not getting frozen in roles that are dictated by circumstances beyond our control. Lee herself was the perfect example of this. Lee had come to Disney as a new film school graduate with little besides a young daughter and a fresh divorce and student loans, and had quickly become a screenwriter at one of the biggest studios on Earth. Now she was the first female director in Disney's history. Kristen and Bobby were examples of people escaping their circumstances as well. They had fought for years to build the careers they wanted, even when everyone said it was ridiculous to hope they could support themselves by writing songs. Now, here they were, with hit Broadway shows and the life they had always hoped for. To earn Frozen's ending, Kristen said, they had to find a way to share that sense of possibility with the audience. What is it for you? Kristen typed. Lee replied 23 minutes later. It was 7 in the morning in Los Angeles. I love your therapist, she wrote, and you. All the different members of the Frozen team had their own ideas for the movie. Everyone on the story trust had become locked into their own concept of how the film should end. But none of them fit together perfectly, Lee felt. However, Frozen could have only one ending. Someone had to make a choice. And the right decision, Lee wrote, is that fear destroys us. Love heals us. Anna's journey should be about learning what love is. It's that simple. At the end of the film, when she sees her sister out on the fjords, she completes her arc by the ultimate act of true love. Sacrificing your needs for someone else's. Love is a greater force than fear. Go with love. Becoming a director forced Lee to see things differently, and that small jolt was enough to help her realize what the film needed and to shift everyone else enough to agree with her. Later that month, Lee sat down with John Lasseter. We need clarity, she told him. The core of this movie isn't about good and evil, because that doesn't happen in real life. And this movie isn't about love versus hate. That's not why sisters grow apart. This is a movie about love and fear. Anna is all about love, and Elsa is all about fear. Anna has been abandoned, so she throws herself into the arms of Prince Charming because she doesn't know the difference between real love and infatuation. She has to learn that love is about sacrifice. And Elsa has to learn that you can't be afraid of who you are. You can't run away from your own powers. You have to embrace your strengths. That's what we need to do with the ending. Show that love is stronger than fear. Say it again, Lasseter told her. Lee described her theory of love versus fear again, explaining how Olaf, the snowman, embodies innocent love, while Prince Hans demonstrates that love without sacrifice isn't really love at all. It's narcissism. Say it again, Lasseter said. Lee said it again. Now go tell the team, said Lasseter. In June 2013, a few months before the movie was set to open, the Frozen team flew to a theater in Arizona to conduct a test screening. What appeared on the screen was completely different from what had been shown in the Disney screening room 15 months earlier. Anna, the younger sister, was now bubbly, optimistic, and lonely. Elsa was loving but scared of her own powers and tortured by the memory of accidentally injuring her sister when they were young. Elsa runs away to an ice castle, intending to live far from humanity, but she inadvertently plunges her kingdom into an endless winter and partially freezes Anna's heart. Anna begins searching for a prince in the hope that his true love's kiss will melt the ice in her chest. But the man she finds, Prince Hans, turns out to be intent on taking the throne for himself. Prince Hans imprisons Elsa and abandons the slowly freezing Anna, intent on killing both sisters so he can seize the crown. Elsa escapes from her cell and, near the end of the movie, is running across the frozen fjords, fleeing the corrupt prince. Anna is growing weaker as the ice inside her chest consumes her heart. A blizzard swirls around the sisters and Hans as they all find one another on the frozen sea. Anna is almost dead from the chill inside her body. Hans raises his sword, ready to slay Elsa and put the throne within his reach. As Hans's blade falls, however, Anna steps in front of the blow. Her body turns to ice just as the sword descends, and it strikes her frozen body rather than her sister. By sacrificing herself, Anna has saved Elsa, and this act of devotion, this genuine demonstration of true love, finally melts Anna's chest. She returns to life, and Elsa, released from the anxiety that she'll hurt the people she loves, can now direct her powers to defeat the evil Hans. She knows now how to end the kingdom's winter. The sisters, united, are powerful enough to overcome their enemies and their self-doubts. Hans is expelled, spring returns, and love defeats fear. All the elements of a traditional Disney plot were included. There were princesses and ball gowns, a handsome prince, a wisecracking sidekick, and a stream of upbeat songs. But throughout the film, those elements had been disturbed just enough to let something new and different emerge. Prince Hans wasn't charming. He was the villain. The princesses weren't helpless. Instead, they saved each other. True love didn't arrive in a rescue. Rather, it came from siblings learning to embrace their own strengths. "When did this movie get so good?" Kristen Anderson Lopez whispered to Peter Delveco as the screening ended. Frozen would go on to win the Academy Award for Best Animated Feature of 2014. Let It Go would win the Academy Award for Best Original Song. The film would become the top-grossing animated movie of all time. Creativity can't be reduced to a formula. At its core, it needs novelty, surprise, and other elements that cannot be planned in advance to seem fresh and new. There is no checklist that, if followed, delivers innovation on demand. But the creative process is different. We can create the conditions that help creativity to flourish. We know, for example, that innovation becomes more likely when old ideas are mixed in new ways. We know the odds of success go up when brokers, people with fresh, different perspectives who have seen ideas in a variety of settings, draw on the diversity within their heads. We know that sometimes a little disturbance can help jolt us out of the ruts that even the most creative thinkers fall into, as long as those shakeups are the right size. If you want to become a broker and increase the productivity of your own creative process, there are three things that can help. First, be sensitive to your own experiences. Pay attention to how things make you think and feel. That's how we distinguish clichés from true insights. As Steve Jobs put it, the best designers are those who have thought more about their experiences than other people. Similarly, the Disney process asks filmmakers to look inward, to think about their own emotions and experiences until they find answers that make imaginary characters come alive. Jerry Robbins pushed his West Side Story collaborators to put their own aspirations and emotions on the stage. Look to your own life as creative fodder and broker your own experiences into the wider world. Second, recognize that the panic and stress you feel as you try to create isn't a sign that everything is falling apart. Rather, it's the condition that helps make us flexible enough to seize something new. Creative desperation can be critical. Anxiety is what often pushes us to see old ideas in new ways. The path out of that turmoil is to look at what you know to re-inspect conventions you've seen work and try to apply them to fresh problems. The creative pain should be embraced. Finally, remember that the relief accompanying a creative breakthrough, while sweet, can also blind us to seeing alternatives. It is critical to maintain some distance from what we create. Without self-criticism, without tension, one idea can quickly crowd out competitors. But we can regain that critical distance by forcing ourselves to critique what we've already done, by making ourselves look at it from a completely different perspective, by changing the power dynamics in the room, or giving new authority to someone who didn't have it before. Disturbances are essential, and we retain clear eyes by embracing destruction and upheaval, as long as we're sensitive to making the disturbance the right size. There's an idea that runs through these three lessons. The creative process is, in fact, a process, something that can be broken down and explained. That's important, because it means that anyone can become more creative. We can all become innovation brokers. We all have experiences and tools, disturbances and tensions that can make us into brokers. If, that is, we're willing to embrace that desperation and upheaval and try to see our old ideas in new ways. Creativity is just problem solving, Ed Catmull told me. Once people see it as problem solving, it stops seeming like magic, because it's not. Brokers are just people who pay more attention to what problems look like and how they've been solved before. People who are most creative are the ones who have learned that feeling scared is a good sign. We just have to learn how to trust ourselves enough to let the creativity out. Chapter 8. Absorbing Data. Turning Information into Knowledge in Cincinnati's Public Schools. Students were settling into their seats as the PA system crackled to life inside South Avondale Elementary School. "This is Principal Macon," a voice said. "I am declaring a hot pencil drill. Please prepare yourselves, prepare your worksheets, and we will begin in 5, 4, 3, 2. 2 minutes and 33 seconds later, 8-year-old Dante Williams slammed down his pencil, shot his hand into the air, and twitched impatiently as the teacher scribbled his finish time at the top of the multiplication quiz. Then Dante was out of his chair and flying through the door of his third-grade classroom, arms pumping as he speed-walked down the hallway, his worksheet creased in his fist. 3 years earlier, in 2007, when Dante entered kindergarten, South Avondale had been ranked as one of the worst schools in Cincinnati, which, given that the city had some of the lowest scores in the state, meant that the school was among the worst in Ohio. That year, South Avondale students had fared so poorly on their assessment exams that officials declared the school an academic emergency. Just weeks before Dante had stepped onto campus for the first time, a teenager had been murdered, one bullet to the head, one in the back, right next to South Avondale during a football tournament billed as a Peace Bowl. That crime, combined with the school's deep dysfunctions, poor academic scores, and a general sense that South Avondale had problems too big for anyone to solve, had caused city officials to ask if the Board of Education should close the campus altogether. The question, however, was where would they send Dante and his classmates? Nearby schools had scored only slightly better on assessment exams, and if those classrooms were forced to absorb additional kids, they would likely fall apart as well. The community around South Avondale had been poor for decades. There were race riots in the 1960s, and when the city's factories started closing in the 70s, the area's unemployment had skyrocketed. South Avondale administrators saw students coming to school malnourished and with marks of abuse. In the 1980s, The drug trade around the school exploded and never really let up. At times, the violence got so bad that police would patrol the campus's perimeter while classes were in session. "It could be a pretty scary place," said Yezveta Makin, who was principal from 2009 to 2013. Students didn't go to South Avondale unless there was no other place to go. One thing that wasn't a problem, however, was resources. The city of Cincinnati had poured millions of dollars into South Avondale. Local companies such as Procter & Gamble built computer labs and paid for tutoring and sports programs. In an effort to address the school's shortcomings, city officials spent nearly three times as many dollars on every South Avondale student as they did on students in more affluent communities, such as at the public Montessori campus across town. South Avondale had energetic teachers, devoted librarians and tutors, reading specialists, and guidance counselors who were trained in early childhood education and prepared to help parents sign up for state and federal assistance programs. The school also used sophisticated software to track students' performance. Administrators had embraced data collection, and Cincinnati Public Schools had created an individual website for every South Avondale student, a dashboard of information that detailed kids' attendance, test scores, homework, and classroom participation that was accessible to parents and educators so they could track who was improving and who was falling behind. The school's faculty received a steady stream of memos and spreadsheets showing how each pupil had fared over the past week, month, and year. South Avondale, in fact, was at the forefront of educational big data. K-12 schools should have a clear strategy for developing a data-driven culture, read a U.S. Department of Education report that helped guide Cincinnati's efforts. By studying each student's statistics closely enough, educators believed they could deliver the specific kind of assistance each kid needed most. "Any idea or new program, we signed up for," said Elizabeth Holtzapfel, Director of Research and Evaluation at Cincinnati Public Schools. "We had seen how data and analytics had turned around other districts, and we were on board." The turnaround at South Avondale, however, was nowhere to be found. 6 years after the online dashboards were introduced, more than 90% of South Avondale's teachers admitted they hardly ever looked at them, or used the data sent by the district, or read the memos they received each week. In 2008, 63% of South Avondale's third graders failed to meet the state's basic educational benchmarks. So, that year, Cincinnati decided to try something different. The district's top officials targeted South Avondale and 15 other low-performing campuses in what became known as the Elementary Initiative, or EI. The effort was perhaps most notable for what it lacked. The schools were given no additional funds or supplementary teachers. There were no new tutoring sessions or after-school programs. The staff and student body at each campus remained basically the same. Instead, the EI focused on changing how teachers made decisions in their classrooms. The reforms were built around the idea that data can be transformative, but only if people know how to use it. To change students' lives, educators had to understand how to transform all the spreadsheets and statistics and online dashboards into insights and plans. They had to be forced to interact with data until it influenced how they behaved. By the time Dante entered the third grade, 2 years after the EI started, the program was already so successful it was hailed by the White House as a model of inner-city reform. South Avondale's test scores went up so much that the school earned an excellent rating from state officials. By the end of Dante's third grade year, 80% of his classmates were reading at grade level. 84% passed the state math exam. The school had quadrupled the number of students meeting the state's guidelines. South Avondale drastically improved student academic performance in the 2010 to 11 academic year and Change the Culture of the School, a review by the school district read. The school's transformation was so startling that researchers from around the nation soon began traveling to Cincinnati to figure out what the elementary initiative was doing right. When those researchers visited South Avondale, teachers told them that the most important ingredient in the school's turnaround was data. The same data, in fact, that the district had been collecting for years. Teachers said that a data-driven culture had actually transformed how they made classroom decisions. When pressed, however, those teachers also said they rarely looked at the online dashboards or memos or spreadsheets the central office sent around. In fact, the EI was succeeding because teachers had been ordered to set aside those slick data tools and fancy software, and were told instead to start manipulating information by hand. Each school, under orders from the central office, had established a data room, in some cases an empty conference room, in others a large closet that had previously contained cleaning supplies, where teachers had to transcribe test scores onto index cards. They were told to draw graphs on butcher paper that was taped to walls. They ran impromptu experiments. Do test scores improve if kids are placed in smaller reading groups? What happens when teachers trade off classes? And then scribbled the results onto whiteboards. Rather than simply receiving information, teachers were forced to engage with it. The EI had worked because instead of passively absorbing data, teachers made it disfluent, harder to process at first, but stickier once it was really understood. By scribbling out statistics and testing preconceptions, teachers had figured out how to use all the information they were receiving. The elementary initiative, paradoxically, had made data more cumbersome to absorb, but more useful. And from those index cards and hand-drawn graphs, better classrooms emerged. Something special happened inside those data rooms, said Macon, the principal. South Avondale improved not because teachers had more information, but because they learned how to understand it. With Google and the Internet and all the information we have now, you can find answers to almost anything in seconds, said Macon. But South Avondale shows there's a difference between finding an answer and understanding what it means. 2. In the past 2 decades, the amount of information embedded in our daily lives has skyrocketed. There are smartphones that count our steps, websites that track our spending, digital maps to plot our commutes, software that watches our web browsing, and apps to manage our schedules. We can precisely measure how many calories we eat each day, how much our cholesterol scores have improved each month, how many dollars we spend at restaurants, and how many minutes were allocated to the gym. This information can be incredibly powerful. If harnessed correctly, data can make our days more productive, our diets healthier, our schools more effective, and our lives less stressful. Unfortunately, however, our ability to learn from information hasn't necessarily kept pace with its proliferation. Though we can track our spending and cholesterol, we still often eat and spend in ways we know we should avoid. Even simple uses of information, such as choosing a restaurant or a new credit card, haven't necessarily become more simple. To find a good Chinese restaurant, is it better to consult Google, ask your Facebook feed, call up a friend, or search your browser history to see where you ordered from last time? To figure out which credit card to sign up for, should you consult an online guide, call your bank, open those envelopes piling up on the dining room table? In theory, the ongoing explosion in information should make the right answers more obvious. In practice, though, being surrounded by data often makes it harder to decide. This inability to take advantage of data as it becomes more plentiful is called information blindness. Just as snow blindness refers to people losing the capacity to distinguish trees from hills under a blanket of powder, so information blindness refers to our mind's tendency to stop absorbing data when there's too much to take in. One study of information blindness was published in 2004 when a group of researchers at Columbia University tried to figure out why some people sign up for 401k retirement plans while others don't. They studied almost 800,000 people across hundreds of companies who were offered opportunities to enroll in 401k plans. For many workers, signing up for the retirement plans should have been an easy choice. The 401ks offered large tax savings, and many of the companies in the study promised to match employees' contributions, in effect giving them free money. And at firms where workers were offered information on two 401k options, 75% enrolled. Employees at those companies told researchers that signing up seemed obvious. They looked at the two brochures, picked the plan that seemed most sensible, and then watched their retirement accounts grow fatter over time. At other companies, even as the number of plans to choose among increased, sign-ups remained high. When workers were offered 25 different kinds of plans, 72% of them enrolled. But when employees received information on more than 30 plans, something seemed to change. The amount of information people were receiving became so overwhelming that workers stopped making good choices, or, in some cases, any choice at all. At 39 plans, only 65% of people signed up for 401k accounts. At 60 plans, participation dropped to 53%. Every 10 funds added was associated with 1.5% to 2% drop in participation, the researchers wrote in their 2004 study. Signing up for a 401k was still the right decision, but when information became too plentiful, people put the brochures in a drawer and never looked at them again. We've found this in dozens of settings, said Martin Eppler, a professor at the University of St. Gallen in Switzerland who studies information overload. The quality of people's decisions generally gets better as they receive more relevant information. But then their brain reaches a breaking point when the data becomes too much. They start ignoring options or making bad choices or stop interacting with the information completely. Information blindness occurs because of the way our brain's capacity for learning has evolved. Humans are exceptionally good at absorbing information, as long as we can break data into a series of smaller and smaller pieces. This process is known as winnowing or scaffolding. Mental scaffolds are like file cabinets filled with folders that help us store and access information when the need arises. If someone is handed a huge wine list at a restaurant, for instance, they'll typically have no problem making a selection, because their brain will automatically place what they know about wine into a scaffold of categories they can use to make binary decisions. Do I want a white or a red? White. And then finer subcategories, expensive or cheap? Cheap. Until they confront a final comparison, the $6 Chardonnay or the $7 Sauvignon Blanc, that draws upon what they have already learned about themselves. I like Chardonnay. We do this so quickly that, most of the time, we're hardly aware it's occurring. Our brains crave reducing things to two or three options, said Eric Johnson, a cognitive psychologist at Columbia University who studies decision-making. So when we're faced with a lot of information, we start automatically arranging it into mental folders and subfolders and sub-subfolders. This ability to digest large amounts of information by breaking it into smaller pieces is how our brains turn information into knowledge. We learn which facts or lessons to apply in a given situation by learning which folders to consult. Experts are distinguished from novices, in part, by how many folders they carry in their heads. An enophile will look at a wine list and immediately rely on a vast system of folders, such as vintage and region, that don't occur to novices. The enophile has learned how to organize information, choose the year first, then look at the pricing, in ways that make it less overwhelming. So while a novice is flipping through pages, the expert is already ignoring whole sections of the wine list. So when we are presented with information on 60 different 401k plans and no obvious way to start analyzing them, our brains pivot to a more binary decision. Do I try to make sense of all this information, or just stick everything in my drawer and ignore it? One way to overcome information blindness is to force ourselves to grapple with the data in front of us, to manipulate information by transforming it into a sequence of questions to be answered or choices to be made. This is sometimes referred to as creating disfluency, because it relies on doing a little bit of work. Instead of simply choosing the house wine, you have to ask yourself a series of questions: white or red, expensive or cheap. Instead of sticking all the 401k brochures into a drawer, you have to contrast the plan's various benefits and make a choice. It might seem like a small effort at the time, but those tiny bits of labor are critical to avoiding information blindness. The process of creating disfluency can be as minor as forcing ourselves to compare a few pages on a menu, or as big as building a spreadsheet to calculate 401k payouts. But regardless of the intensity of the effort, the underlying cognitive activity is the same. We are taking a mass of information and forcing it through a procedure that makes it easier to digest. The important step seems to be performing some kind of operation, said Adam Alter, a professor at NYU who has studied disfluency. If you make people use a new word in a sentence, they'll remember it longer. If you make them write down a sentence with a word, they'll start using it in conversations. When Alter conducts experiments, he sometimes gives people instructions in a hard-to-read font because, as they struggle to make out the words, they read the text more carefully. The initial difficulty in processing the text leads you to think more deeply about what you're reading, so you spend more time and energy making sense of it, he said. When you ask yourself a few questions about wine or compare the fees on various 401k plans, the data becomes less monolithic and more like a series of decisions. When information is made disfluent, we learn more. In 1997, executives running the debt collection division of Chase Manhattan Bank began wondering why a particular group of employees in Tampa, Florida, were so much more successful than their peers at convincing people to pay their credit card bills. Chase, at the time, was one of the largest credit card issuers in the nation. As a result, it was also one of the largest debt collectors. It employed thousands of people in offices all over the country who sat in cubicles all day and called debtor after debtor to harass them about overdue credit card bills. Chase knew from internal surveys that debt collectors didn't especially like their jobs, and executives had grown accustomed to lackluster performance. The company had tried to make the work easier by giving collectors tools to help them convince debtors to pay. As each call occurred, for instance, the computer in front of the debt collector served up information that would assist in tailoring their pitch. It told them the debtor's age, how frequently he or she had paid off their balances, how many other credit cards they owned, what conversational tactics had proven successful in the past. Employees were sent to training sessions and given daily memos with charts and graphs showing the success of various collection tactics. But almost none of the employees, Chase found, paid much attention to the information they received. No matter how many classes Chase provided or memos they sent, collection rates never seemed to improve much. So executives were pleasantly surprised when one team in Tampa started collecting larger than usual amounts. That group was overseen by a manager named Charlotte Flood, an evangelical minister in training with a passion for long skirts and Hooters chicken wings, who had started out as a debt collector herself and had worked her way through the ranks until she was overseeing a group responsible for some of the hardest accounts, debtors who were 120 to 150 days overdue. Cardholders that far in arrears almost never paid off their balances. However, Flood's group was collecting $1 million more per month than any other collection team, even as they were going after some of the most reticent debtors. What's more, Flood's group reported some of Chase's highest employee satisfaction scores. Even the debtors they collected from, in follow-up surveys, said they had appreciated how they had been treated. Chase's executives hoped Flood might share her tactics with other managers, and so they asked her to speak at the company's regional meeting at the Innisbrook Resort near Tampa. The title of her talk was Optimizing the Mosaics VoiceLink Auto Dialer System. The room was packed. "Can you tell us how you schedule your auto dialer?" one manager asked. "Carefully," Flood said. "From 9:15 a.m. to 11:50 a.m., she explained, the collectors called people's home numbers because they were more likely to reach a wife taking care of the kids. Women were more likely to send in a check," Flood said. "Then, from noon to 1:30, we call debtors' work numbers," Flood explained, "and we get a lot more men, but you can start the conversation by saying, 'Oh, I'm so glad I caught you on your way to lunch,' like he's real important and his schedule is busy, because that way he'll want to live up to your expectations and he'll promise to pay. Then, at dinner time, we call people we think are unmarried, because they're more likely to be lonely and will want to talk. And then, right after dinner, we call people whose balances have ballooned up and down, because if they've already had a glass of wine and they're relaxed, we can remind them how good it feels to start paying the card off." Flood had dozens of tips like these. She had advice on when to use a comforting tone, if you hear soap operas in the background, when collectors should reveal personal details, if the debtor mentions kids, and when to deploy a stern approach to anyone invoking religion. The other managers didn't know what to make of these suggestions. All of them sounded perfectly logical, but they didn't think their employees would be able to use any of them. The average debt collector had just a high school diploma. For many collectors, this was their first full-time job. Managers mostly spent their time reminding employees to avoid sounding so wooden on the phone. Their debt collectors weren't going to be able to pay attention to what television shows were playing in the background or listen for religious references. No one was adept enough at analyzing debtors' records to figure out how to reach a housewife versus her husband. They just talked to whoever picked up the phone. Chase might send the collectors memos each morning. The company might give them computer screens of information and provide them with classes. But managers knew almost no one actually read those memos or looked at the screens or used what they learned in class. Simply having a phone conversation with a stranger about a sensitive issue like an overdue bill was overwhelming enough on its own. The average collector couldn't process additional information while conducting a call. But when Flood was asked why her employees were so effective at processing more information than the average collector, she didn't have any great answers. She couldn't explain why her workers seemed to absorb so much more. So after the conference, Chase hired the consulting firm Mitchell Madison Group to examine her methods. "How did you figure out that it's better to call women in the morning?" a consultant named Tracy Entel asked her when Flood was back in the office. "Do you want me to show you my calendar?" said Flood. The consultants weren't certain why she needed a calendar to explain her methods, but sure, they said, "let's see the calendar." They expected Flood to pull out a date book or journal. Instead, she dropped a binder onto the table. Then she wheeled over a cart containing several more binders just like it. "Okay," Flood said, leafing through pages filled with numbers and scribbled notes. She found the sheet she was looking for. One day, I came up with this idea that it would be easier to collect from younger people because I figured they're more eager to keep a good credit score, she said. Flood explained that coming up with such theories was common on her team. Employees would gather during lunch breaks or after work to kick around ideas. Typically, these ideas didn't make much sense, at least at first. In fact, the ideas were often somewhat nonsensical, such as the suggestion that an irresponsible young person who was already behind on her debts, for some reason, would suddenly care deeply about improving her credit score. But that was okay. The point wasn't to suggest a good idea. It was to generate an idea, any idea at all, and then test it. Flood looked at her calendar. So the next day, we started calling people between the ages of 21 and 37. At the end of the shift, employees reported no noticeable change in how much they had convinced people to pay. So the following morning, Flood changed one variable. She told her employees to call people between the ages of 26 and 31. The collection rate improved slightly. The next day, they called a subset of that group, cardholders between 26 and 31 with balances between $3,000 and $6,000. Collection rates declined. The next day, cardholders with balances between $5,000 and $8,000. That led to the highest collection rates of the week. In the evenings, before everyone left, managers gathered to review the day's results and speculate on why certain efforts had succeeded or failed. They printed out logs and circled which calls had gone particularly well. That was Flood's calendar. The printouts from each day with annotations and employees' comments, as well as notes suggesting why certain tactics had worked so well. With further testing, Flood determined that her original theory regarding young people was a dud. That, in itself, wasn't surprising. Most of the theories were duds initially. Employees had all kinds of hunches that didn't bear up under testing. But as each experiment unfolded, workers became increasingly sensitive to patterns they hadn't noticed before. They listened more closely. They tracked how debtors would respond to various questions. And eventually, a valuable insight would emerge. Like, say, it's better to call people's homes between 9:15 and 11:50 in the morning because the wife will pick up and women are more likely to pay a family's debts. Sometimes, the debt collectors would develop instincts they couldn't exactly put into words, but learn to heed nonetheless. Then, someone would propose a new theory or experiment, and the process would start all over again. When you track every call and keep notes and talk about what just happened with a person in the next cubicle, you start paying attention differently, Flood told me. You learn to pick up on things. To the consultants, this was an example of someone using the scientific method to isolate and test variables. Charlotte's peers would generally change multiple things at once, wrote Nico Cantor, one of the consultants, in a review of his findings. Charlotte would only change one thing at a time. Therefore, she understood the causality better. But something else was going on as well. It wasn't just that Flood was isolating variables. Rather, by coming up with hypotheses and testing them, Flood's team was heightening their sensitivity to the information flowing past. In a sense, they were adding an element of disfluency to their work, performing operations on the data generated during each conversation until lessons were easier to absorb. The spreadsheets and memos that they received each morning, the data that appeared on their screens, the noises they heard in the background of phone calls, that became material for coming up with new theories and running various experiments. Each phone call contained tons of information that most collectors never registered. But Flood's employees noticed it because they were looking for clues to prove or disprove theories. They were interacting with the data embodied in each conversation, turning it into something they could use. This is how learning occurs. Information gets absorbed almost without our noticing because we're so engrossed with it. Flood took the torrent of data arriving each day and gave her team a method for placing it into folders that made it easier to understand. She helped her employees do something with all those memos they received and the conversations they were having. And as a result, it was easier for them to learn. 3. Nancy Johnson became a teacher in Cincinnati because she didn't know what else to do with her life. It had taken her 7 years to make it through college, and after graduating, she'd become a flight attendant, married a pilot, and then decided to settle down. In 1996, she started substituting in Cincinnati's public schools, hoping it would lead to a full-time job. She went from classroom to classroom, guiding classes on everything from English to biology, until she finally got a permanent offer as a fourth-grade teacher. On her first day, the principal saw her and said, "So you're Ms. Johnson." He later admitted he had gotten a number of applications with the same last name and wasn't fully certain which one he had hired. A few years later, in response to the federal government's No Child Left Behind law, Cincinnati began tracking students' performances in reading and math via standardized exams. Johnson was soon drowning in reports. Each week, she received memos on students' attendance and their progress in vocabulary, math proficiency, reading, writing, literature comprehension, and something called cognitive manipulation, as well as reviews of her classroom's proficiency, her teaching aptitude, and the school's overall scores. There was so much information that the city had hired a team of data visualization experts to design the weekly memos the district delivered via the internet dashboards. The graphics team was talented. The charts Johnson received were easy to read, and the internet sites contained clear summaries and color-coded trend lines. But in those first few years, Johnson hardly looked at any of it. She was supposed to use all that information in designing her curricula, but it made her head hurt. There were lots of memos and statistics, and I knew I was supposed to be incorporating them into my classroom, but it all just kind of washed over me, she said. It felt like there was this gap between all those numbers and what I needed to know to become a better teacher. Her fourth grade kids were mostly poor, and many were from single-parent families. She was a good teacher, but her class still fared badly on assessment exams. In 2007, the year before Cincinnati's elementary initiative began, her students scored an average of 38% proficiency on the state's reading test. Then, in 2008, the elementary initiative was launched. As part of that reform, Johnson's principal mandated that all teachers had to spend at least 2 afternoons a month in the school's new data room. Around a conference table, teachers were forced to participate in exercises that made data collection and statistical tabulation even more time-consuming. At the start of the semester, Johnson and her colleagues were told that as part of the EI, they had to create an index card for every student in their class. Then, every other Wednesday, Johnson would go into the data room and transcribe the past 2 weeks' test scores onto each student's card, and then group all the cards into color-coded piles, red, yellow, or green, based on whether students were underperforming, meeting expectations, or exceeding their peers. As the semester progressed, she also began grouping cards based on who was improving or falling behind over time. It was intensely boring, and, frankly, it seemed redundant, because all this information was already available on the students' online dashboards. Moreover, many of the people in that room had been teaching for decades. They didn't feel like they needed piles of cards to tell them what was going on in their own classrooms. But an order was an order, and so they went into the data room every other week. The rule was that everyone had to actually handle the cards, physically move them around, Johnson said. Everyone hated it, at least at first.